Hi, once again, welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Today, we convene the Science Forum as we have gathered a trio of scientific experts to respond to your questions and comments. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also contact us via these social media links. You can comment at the bottom of today's show page on the Vox Pop section of our website, WAMC.org/VoxPop. You can comment below today's Vox Pop wall post on our Facebook page. It's facebook.com/WAMC radio. You can tweet your questions and comments at WAMC Vox Pop, or you can email us at VoxPop@WAMC.org. Be nice to have a call or two, however. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. And now, let's meet our panel of experts.
Ed Stander, SUNY Cobleskill, geology, astronomy, and anything Barb can't answer.
Okay.
Hi, Barb Robetz, carpooler with Ed Stander from also SUNY Cobleskill, biochemist.
Helen Girardella, Department of Biology, SUNY Albany, somewhere between biology and photonics, physics, or whatever.
Wow. Okay.
Whatever.
Yeah, you didn't mention.
It's the whatever. That's the important.
You didn't mention that they can come over to Central Avenue and barge their way in and ask us questions, too.
Okay, thanks, Ed. Anybody have anything of substance to bring to the show aside from that?
You know science. It's all fluff, no matter. But I'm Bob.
Hey. All right. There's our first one-liner. Helen, do you have anything funny to say that you can say on the radio?
I didn't have lunch yet.
That's funny. I got a cream cheese and jelly in the fridge. You want it?
No.
All right.
Well, I got a question at the Chinese grocery today.
Okay.
The fortune cookie. I was told everyone I was going to say this, is how much deeper would the ocean be without sponges? That's a science question for you.
And you know what I answered? It would be not as deep because the sponges actually displace water because they have mass.
Which took all the fun out of the question.
This is what the Science Forum is all about.
Now what are we going to do for the next 50 minutes?
Well, let's go to the phones. Sarah in East Greenbush, you're first.
Hi. I have a question that stemmed from my eighth grader's earth science homework. And we're trying to figure out, so in the summer, the sun rises sort of in the northeast, and in the winter, sort of in the southeast. And right at the equinox, I think, the sun is supposed to be rising directly east. And I'm wondering if that's the case in everywhere on Earth on that day, if the sun is rising directly to the east. And if so, how is that possible? Because we're like standing in different places, but all looking at the same point.
Ah.
Well, you pretty well answered it yourself. That's right. If you're on the equator, if you're on the equator, it would rise directly from the east and set in the west, anywhere on the equator. And as you go north, it'll be a little bit south of you. And if you're south, it'll be a little bit north of you.
And can't you actually figure out how far away from the equinox from the equator you are on the equinox by looking at the angle that the sun rises at?
Not the sun rises, but you can tell how far you are above the equator by looking where it is at noon, when it's at its highest point.
Right. So you can look at the shadow cast on a stick, say at noon, on March 21st or September 21st. And a little trigonometry later, and you know what your latitude is.
Right.
Right. Yeah, the sun will rise north of us here, and it will rise south of us. It all depends on what time of the year it is.
But on the equinox, it's always straight east.
No, it'll only be straight east if you're on the equator.
Oh, only on the equator.
That's correct, because on the effectively, on the equinox, the sun is directly over the equator, so you have no shadow if you're at the equator.
Okay.
Okay.
So when is it going to, so say you're on the North Pole on the equinox, where's the sun rising?
Well, it'll rise awfully far south of you, actually.
A little south.
In fact,
it won't rise at all certain times a year.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. Sarah, thank you.
Okay. I have to think about this. All right,
okay.
Thank you.
Sure.
Right,
and there's a Tropic of Cancer and a Tropic of Capricorn. Which one's which?
Well, the Tropic of Cancer is as far north as the sun goes, and the Tropic of Cancer is as far south as the sun goes.
All right. 1-800-348-2551 is the Science Forum, as you may have guessed. Duncan, where are you, Duncan?
I'm at home now, but I'm sitting in my driveway.
Okay, where are you calling from?
Freehold, New York.
All right, well, you are on.
Okay, thanks, Ray. I've been wanting to do this for a while. My DNA is in the system. Okay, it's there for whatever reason.
Right.
And I have surgery, and I get 7 units of blood. And they let me go, and I go out and I do a nefarious act and I leave a blood sample. They take it and they do a DNA match on it. Are they going to find me or are they going to find one of my daughters?
Yeah, and 7 units of blood, that's a lot of blood.
I was bleeding inside, and that's what happened, and nobody could answer me.
Well, the answer is pretty simple. You would leave a mixture of both your own blood and the blood that you were transfused with, and I'm sure the 7 units didn't come all out of the same person.
Probably not.
It would be a mixture of probably 7 people plus yourself. So, but the thing is, you just don't leave DNA behind from blood. You also leave DNA behind in your oil and your skin cells and other cells. So this is actually, there was a physician back in the 90s who raped women who actually put fake blood in his system so that when they drew his blood, it would not match the semen at the crime scene. But usually when you do a DNA test these days, it's not with blood. It's usually a swab in your cheek because blood actually contains very little DNA.
Yeah, I do understand that. I was just, you know, the blood was the question. It was driving me bananas. I'd walk the dogs in the morning and it'd be floating through my head all the time.
Interesting question. Right. Well, thanks, Duncan.
But within 3 months, the blood would be replaced with your own because your blood does expire and is recycled.
Thank you very much. That's a great answer. Appreciate it.
All right. It is the Science Forum on WAMC. I'm glad that the blood recycles. Keith Richard would be in trouble without that. Yes?
Yes. That's what your spleen is for.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, spleen. John in Albany, you're next. John, are you there?
Yes. Sorry.
Go ahead.
So I'm wondering what happens at the very point of a transmitter that emits radio waves. I can't quite get my hands around what is actually happening. Like, I can see a stone in water. I understand light waves. But, like, what force is actually happening when the initial, like, at the top of a radio tower, like, what's there that's emitting? Like, I don't get the electric or mechanical or physical or, like, what? How do radio waves become emitted?
Okay.
Well, let's do it with light so we can have everyone visualize it. So say I was a beacon of light, say in a lighthouse, and I turn it on and I turn it off, and I turn it on and I turn it off. So what is propagating through space? What do I see if I'm on a ship out at sea? I see a light beam, right?
Yes, but that's the gas of a light that's you know, jumping phases or whatever emits the light wave. That's kind of been explained in, like, chemistry or whatever, but I can understand how light is emitted. That I get.
Okay, but light is not matter. Matter is releasing the light, but the light itself is not matter. It's energy. And it's energy that we can easily perceive because that's why we call it light. Well, radio is just a type of light that you and I, with our eyeballs, cannot detect. So it's just a different type of light bulb emitting. And emitting at a frequency that's usually set. So this is 90.3.
But he's saying, how does a transmitter work, and what happens at the antenna that sends those waves out? Is that what you want to know, John?
Right. For light, I'm pretty confident that it's gas.
Actually, let me interrupt.
Phases, right?
All right, Helen, go ahead.
It's something we call electromagnetic radiation. In other words, there's energy, radiant energy, so-called, that's being sent out. And depending on how fast the vibrations are or how long the wavelength between each peak is, you can have anything from radio waves or even longer, or go very, very short to short waves and X-rays and gamma rays and so forth. And visual, the light that we see is part of this, if you want to think about this band of radiation that's possible, we're seeing part of it. And the radio waves are another part. And so it's being emitted from the radio tower, and the antennae are tuned to pick up.
It's not the tower that's emitting the wave. What physical thing is doing it? So, like, with sound, you've got the speaker doing it. With light, you've got the gas or whatever.
Light is part of the spectrum of radiation. Radiation is energy. And we can't see it. We can see some parts of it, but we don't feel it as anything solid the way a gas or even gaseous. But it exists in the universe. And depending on this is not a good analogy, but depending on how fast it's vibrating, which is the way we talk about sound, we can either have
vibrating?
Well, not in the way we mean when we talk about sound, no, but we talk about the radiation having a certain wavelength.
And you're just transferring energy from electrical impulse, which is stuff coming from Niagara Mohawk, into radio energy. That's all it is. It's translating it from one energy source to a different energy source. It's not actually being created. It's being transferred from one state to another state because there's this thing called the law of conservation of energy. Energy is neither created nor destroyed. It's just transferred between systems. So even in the case of light, and you talk about a gas that's being in, and the gas is emitting light, it had to gain the energy from somewhere to then in that gas to then emit it. And the same thing happens with an electrical transmitter. You're taking electrons, you're taking the energy that's in those electrons and transferring that energy and sending it out as a coherent vibration in the radio spectrum.
John, we got to take a break here, but thanks for the call. We appreciate it. It's the Science Forum on WAMC.
I was going to point out that
800-348-2551.
You don't need anything. In a vacuum, you could still send
energy. Yep.
Okay, well, let's take a short break. We can pick this up in a moment. Thanks for being here, everybody. We'll be back.
Support comes from the Tang Teaching Museum and Art Gallery at Skidmore College, providing exhibits, public events, and educational programs for audiences of all ages for the Capital District and beyond. 518-580-8080. Charles Padula, DDS, Union Avenue, Schenectady. Family dentistry, including laser cavity detection and computer-aided local anesthesia. PaduladDDS.com. Edward Garbasek, Certified Financial Planner, Havokin Wealth Strategies, Wilbraham, Massachusetts, providing customized financial retirement strategies for those approaching or in retirement. HavokinWealthStrategies.com. And the Henyon Bakery, Amherst, since 1993, offering hearth-baked whole grain breads, pastries, birthday, wedding, and special occasion cakes, as well as gluten-free offerings. HenyonBakery.com.
one 800 348 2551 is the number, and it is the Science Forum on WAMC, and we've had a couple of interesting calls already. It spurred some interesting conversation here, and I asked if we talked about the wavelengths that, you know, we can perceive. In other words, we can perceive part of that spectrum of radiation that is visible, that we call visible light.
Right.
And I had asked the panel while we were in break whether there are some critters out there that could actually pick up radio waves directly.
Mm-hmm. And along with the example I gave is insects, they're somewhat attracted to certain frequencies of radio wave. So they're influenced, their flights are influenced by them as well. But another one that came to mind after we started talking about it is whales, actually, are influenced by it.
Very low frequencies?
Very long frequency, long wave, very low energy radio waves. They transmit over very long distances. And the Navy used to use this as a means of communicating with its submarines in the oceans. And it had influence upon the whale patterns. And if you're in a submarine, you don't want a whale coming to investigate, really.
No, I guess that's not a good plan. So it would attract the whales?
Well, it would influence the whales. Let me just say it that way. I don't want to talk about, I don't really know what attracts a whale in that sense. But
another whale
would influence their, it would influence their patterns of migration.
Yeah, well, whales themselves are producing radio waves or waves of very, very low frequency themselves. So they're able to hear each other, talk to each other. Their heads of sperm whales, for example, have a very large cavity in the inside, and it actually clicks, it vibrates. Which
but that's for sound waves, right?
It's a resonator, essentially. Right.
Which requires matter. I mean, sound waves only propagate when there's something to move the wave along.
Water, air. Yeah, okay, let's go back to the phones. And Merle in Argyle. Merle, you're on.
All right, hi, folks. My question has to do with charcoal ashes from a charcoal grill and wood ash from a fireplace.
Yep.
The ash in the from the charcoal grill is sits out all the time. When it gets wet, there's a hard surface gets across the top, and it's quite black, and underneath it's just regular charcoal dust, whatever you want to call it. And then when I put wood ash outside, this doesn't happen. It just washes away.
Well, let's talk first about how charcoal is made.
Yeah.
What happens is you take pieces of wood, usually soft woods, usually southern soft woods, and you put them in a kiln, like an enclosed area, and you burn it at relatively low temperature with very little oxygen. This process in chemistry is called pyrolysis. So combustion is kind of like the stuff you do in your wood stove. You throw wood in, you have air coming in, it burns, you see a flame. Pyrolysis is kind of like a prolonged bake, like you cooked your brownies too long. So you have a different chemical process, so you have much more carboniferous matter available in charcoal. So when you combust charcoal, spray the stuff on it and light it on fire and cook your hot dogs, you're twice burning the material. So a lot of the volatiles have already left because they cooked off when you pyrolyzed it in the kiln. But then when you have it out on the barbecue, you're doing the regular combustion. So you're doing the process that you would have done in your wood stove right off the bat. So the fact that two chemical processes have produced the charcoal ash versus one chemical process for the wood ash, it's not surprising that they have different characteristics. Also, it's different woods. They don't use high-value wood in making charcoal.
So it doesn't explain, but you have no idea why the charcoal from the grill gets hard surface on it.
It's because it's been pyrolyzed first before it was combusted. Let me use the brownie analogy again. If you cook brownies too long, in the oven, and then you were to take them out and you were to put them outside in the rain, they too would get kind of that hard, crusty top. And I'm not going to take this as homework because it'll drive me crazy to overcook brownies. But the whole idea is you've created that kind of crusty black char on the top of your brownie. And it's not going to react the same as if I just, you know, threw the whole thing in the wood stove and then looked at the ash. Because it's a different chemical process, you end up with different products.
Oh, okay.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Merle, thank you very much. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum. Doe and Wendell, you're on. Hello? You got to turn your radio down just a little bit, okay? All right. Okay. I'm sorry. We're going to go to George in Connecticut. George.
Hello.
Hello.
Am I in here?
Yep, you're on.
Okay. Hi, folks. I love your show.
Thank you.
I'd like trying to disseminate basic science principles. It's a pretty big problem in our country right now. I just had a couple things I thought I could help out with. One was two questions on the equinox subject. One person asked if you could tell the altitude by the angle of the sunrise during an equinox. And, of course, the correct answer is yes.
Okay, we think we were talking latitude.
Because these two are related. There was another fellow that asked if where the sun would rise on the North Pole during an equinox. And the answer was, I think, way below you. But the correct answer, of course, is that the sun would be on the horizon all day during an equinox, go all the way around you. And so how those two are related is that of course, on the equator during an equinox, the sunrise is perpendicular to the horizon, and on the North Pole, it's parallel to the horizon, and there's trigonometry in between.
All right. Fair enough. You got a question?
Just one other quick helper. A person asked about what happens at an antenna. The correct answer is very simple and basic. The two forms are correctly referred to as the same type of forms of energy, light and radio waves, are correctly called electromagnetic waves. At the antenna, there is a current, a DC current or AC current, that is oscillating back and forth in the antenna, which causes at outside of the antenna an electromagnetic oscillation, which propagates as a wave.
Okay.
That's simple.
Well, hey, George, where are you calling from in Connecticut?
I work for UTC.
Okay.
I'm presently on the road. I live in Barkhamsted. And like I said, I love your show.
Well, I appreciate the call very much. Drive safely. Let's go to Larry in New Paltz. Larry, you're on.
Yes, I'd like to echo the previous caller's comments about the antenna. And just to reiterate, basically, electromagnetic radiation is produced by the acceleration of electrons, and the electrons are accelerated down the antenna wire in one direction, then back in the other direction.
Mm-hmm.
That acceleration produces radiation.
But yeah, the, not the kind you get cancer from either. The light radiation, not ionizing radiation, as most non-scientists think of it.
That's true. For ionizing radiation, you need much more high-energy stuff, like really highly accelerated or decelerated electrons in X-ray devices.
Correct.
But all right.
That's another story. My question relates to whether or not there is any magnetic influence on an electron from a proton. And by that, I mean that from the point of view of the electron, it's the proton that's moving. And, you know, from a kind of relativistic point of view, and if the proton charge is seen as moving, that produces a magnetic field. And I'm wondering, you know, what are the potential possibilities for the proton to affect the electron in a magnetic way as opposed to just the usual electrical attraction that's attracted?
Well, electrical attraction is the strong force that holds atoms together. That's what we know. So for the layperson, that means that positives and negatives are opposite, and that an electron is negative and a proton is positive, and so they have an attraction to each other. But there's also a repulsive force, which is a weak force, which means that the electron is not going to crash into the center of the nucleus as it tries to get attracted to the proton. So in order for an electron to be an electron, it has to not be in the nucleus. That's kind of one of the rules that we see in the quantum world. The issue with the quantum world is that when we think of magnetism and electricity, those are classical physics type of qualities. We think of Maxwell's equations and Faraday and many of the 17th, 18th, and 19th century scientists who were able to investigate electricity and magnetism. The problem is the quantum world does not seem to be influenced by those same forces. For example, gravity seems to have very little influence on the quantum world. So electrons do not seem to be influenced by gravity. We can influence electrons with magnetic fields, and we do that with things like MRI machines. We can take very strong electromagnetic fields and apply them, and we can kind of conform the electrons to all move in a specific pattern, then turn off the field and look as the electrons gain randomness. And from that, we can interpret with a computer what kind of chemical environment those electrons are in. That is, what nucleus they're near or attracted to, and then what they're next to. So that's how MRIs work. But it takes large magnetic influences in order to perturb the electrons in that way.
All right. I think you've diverted quite differently from where I was going, but that's okay.
Well, that's what we do here.
Sorry. If you want to read.
Thank you.
Thanks, Larry. We appreciate the call very much. And the grand diverter there was Barbara Brabets and Ed Sanders here, and Helen Giardella is also here. I'm Ray Graff. Let's go to the phones once again and see who else we can divert. Russ in Half Moon. Russ, you're there.
Hello there. I just have a question. Actually, a comment first. I had family members back in the 30s who used to make charcoal that they would sell to the local hotels in this area, mm-hmm. and it was really a painstaking process. It took days to create a pile of charcoal from all this wood. It was pretty amazing. That's why when I was listening to you talk about it, kind of brought back memories. But my question really is, I go out in the woods hunting, and I get in the woods before the sun comes up, and I sit down, and I swear that right as what I call false dawn, when the sun is first peeking over the horizon, it actually feels as though the temperature drops a few degrees. And I've always wondered whether it's my imagination or it's just the fact that I'm actually cold by that time, or if it actually does get colder, like an inversion almost.
Yeah, I've noticed this too. And I've had a lot of years to kind of think about it without actually reading up on it. But if you think about it, it makes sense. When the sun comes up, and we have humidity, any kind of humidity, it settles as dew or frost. When the sun hits it, you have that an evaporative process that happens, or actually in the case of frost, is subliming, going from the solid to the gaseous state directly. And that takes energy to do that. So you can actually lower the temperature at ground level just after dawn versus just before dawn. So when we say it's darkest before the dawn, it might be true, but it's not coldest before the dawn. It just seems to be just after dawn, within that hour of sunrise, that we get the coldest temps.
I always call it false dawn because it really isn't dawn yet.
Right.
It's just there's a gray hue over the sky.
Mm-hmm. Well, the
so
sun's also.
That I haven't been imagining it all these years.
No, but I'm really anal with my thermometer at home, and I keep track of it, sitting there drinking my coffee,
one
watching.
One kind of thermometer, isn't it? Yeah, that's a good point.
No, that's right. Oh, that was a bad choice.
Thanks for sharing.
Yeah. Sorry.
Well, all right then. And Helen, you wanted to say
well,
something.
Well, no, I was just going to say because of I have to think. Diffraction or refraction? Refraction. The sun doesn't come up actually when it looks like it's coming up, so that may also there may be some psychological
issues. Yeah, and there's the
issues also.
The third part of it is that just before the sun comes up, the sun of course is producing an awful lot of energy variations on the Earth, and that's when you start getting winds as well.
Right.
So the wind starts bringing cold air around much, much faster than it would otherwise.
Hey, Russ, thanks a lot for the call. All right, so you mentioned subliming, Barbara, and I was watching a show on Channel 17 last night. I think it was 17, and it was they did an experiment where they put dry ice. They were talking about Comet Ison, actually.
Yes, yes. Right.
And so they put dry ice in water, and they said, watch it sublime. And so explain to me how it can pass through one state of matter without actually getting to that state of matter.
It's really easy if you're stuff that likes to sublime. But we're so used to water, and water doesn't sublime at these pressures. So what we consider everyday atmospheric pressure, we go from a solid to a liquid and a liquid to a gas. And that liquid to gas transition, the freezing and melting, we're fine with it, right? Nobody asks, why do things melt? How awful. But sublimation happens when you change pressure. There's always a sublimation temperature, even for ice. If you think about it, if you leave your ice cubes in the freezer long enough, they shrink.
Yeah.
They never melt. They're subliming. You're going from the solid state to the gas state in your freezer. Usually if you have a convection or one of those freezers, frost-free freezers that has a fan in it.
Yeah.
So you get the wind that blows over the top of your ice cubes, and you do get very subtle sublimation. And if they stay long enough in your freezer, like mine do, you lose significant little chunks of your ice over time, and you end up with these like nothing ice cubes when you go looking for one.
I always thought, and I guess I was always wrong, that there was a hierarchy, if you will, as far as energy and states of matter. So you had, solid and then liquid and then gas. And it just I can't get my brain around how you could go from solid directly to gas.
Well, if you think of an upside down peace sign, it's hard to do on the radio, but kind of like two legs of a stool and then one line straight up.
Yep.
That's what a phase diagram looks like between solid, liquid, and gas. And on one upward column will have temperature, and on the bottom will have pressure. So you can make you can pick a pressure where anything will sublime. I could sublime wood if I wanted to, if I picked the right pressure. Actually, that's what happens in pyrolysis. So we're back to pyrolysis.
See, you're bringing it right
there
around. Boy, you are a pro.
But sublimation with carbon dioxide just happens that the three legs come together at the pressures that we have in everyday life. You can actually take caffeine and apply a little bit of heat to it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, drink it up, right?
Mm-hmm.
And caffeine sublimes as well. It goes from the solid directly to the gas. It's very hard to get liquid caffeine. Very easy to get gaseous caffeine, and very easy to...
Wow.
So how do we decaffeinate coffee?
Yeah.
We freeze dry it. And what that is we lower the temperature, and the caffeine sublimes out of the coffee beans, and that's how we make decaf coffee.
Wow. But how do you get freeze-dried coffee then that is not decaffeinated?
You don't freeze-dry it.
Well, there's freeze-dried.
You'd have to pressurize it so that you don't sublime it.
Yeah, all right. Let's go back to the phones now that I'm... Okay, now, did we go to Doe? Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, you're on.
Okay, I have a question, two questions. One is, why don't astronauts working on the space station, when they go out of the space station, how come they don't fly off it?
You mean drift off into space?
Yeah, I mean, they're working outside of the space station. Are they magnetized to it, or how come in the stream of air they're going through at high speeds, how come they stay on the station?
There is no stream of air in space at the height that they are.
They're not zipping through space?
Well, they are zipping,
but it's space. It doesn't have gas in it. In other words,
there's no force to push them.
Oh.
In the same way that I'm sitting in a chair right now in Albany, and I'm whipping around the universe. I'm going 650 miles an hour on Earth as Earth turns, but I'm not whipping out of my chair because the chair and I are both going 650 miles an hour.
Oh. Well, when I saw that movie, 2001, a little spacecraft goes zipping
off
into space.
Yep. So, you know, they do things on the space shuttle in the ISS really slowly, like when they dock, when they bring those units together to dock them, they have to do it super slow, because if they have any momentum, they'll actually knock the other spacecraft out of alignment of where it's supposed to be, or they'll bounce off of each other like pool balls. So they have to do everything kind of with deliberate motion and kind of slow, because you don't want to go flinging into space.
All right, we got to take a break here, but thank you very much. 1-800-348-2551 is our telephone number. It's the Science Forum, 1-800-348-2551. More calls coming up.
Support comes from Empire Exhibits and Displays, Albany, New York. Custom exhibits, interactive displays, and commercial casework for trade shows, events, museums, and corporate interiors. EmpireExhibits.com. Reform Pilates Studio, Saratoga Springs, teaching Romana's Pilates, providing a fully equipped studio with Krauts apparatus, private and small group classes. ReformYourBody.com. Berkshire Co-op Market, Great Barrington, offering organic and local groceries for Thanksgiving and working to build a healthy and sustainable community through cooperative engagement. Berkshire.coop. And Smith College Museum of Art, presenting River of Gold, pre-Columbian treasures from Sitio Conti, gold work from an ancient American society in central Panama. Smith.edu/artmuseum for information.
It's Vox Pop. It's the Science Forum on WAMC. 1-800-348-2551 is the telephone number. Let's go to Joseph in Springfield. Hi, Joseph. You're on.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi. I had a question. There's been recent talks about nuclear power being like the obvious choice for the future's fuel crisis. And I'm just wondering why they don't bring up geothermal power.
Some people do.
Yeah, they do. But the real problem with geothermal power is that it's a localized event. There are places where geothermal works very well, and there are a lot of places where it doesn't. So, for example, if you're in Yellowstone, you have no problem with geothermal power.
Or
if you're
Iceland.
In Iceland, geothermal power is the way to go. But geothermal power around here, well, mostly geothermal here is just a storage mechanism. You bury heat effectively in the summer, and then you take it out in the winter. So it isn't an actual source of power. It's more just like a storage power, battery.
So why are Iceland and Korea and other locations better at geothermal than here?
They're better because they're underlain by effectively large bodies of igneous rock that are still cooling off. If you're over near a subduction zone, for example, place where oceanic crust is going down the tubes into the mantle, it'll melt and come up as a volcano. And these are places where there's lots and lots of heat in the crust. So that's the main reason.
Okay. All right, Joseph, thanks a lot. Now, they talk about Yellowstone being on this super volcano.
Yeah.
Caldera, yeah.
And so that would be one of the reasons there's a lot of heat down there?
There's a lot of heat, and it's actually rising. It's rising up to some extent and pushing the crust up as well.
Yeah. It's like a bubble on a pizza. You get a very thin crust on that bubble on your pizza. If you poke it and it's still hot, that bubble kind of oozes.
Yeah.
That's Yellowstone.
Except in the case of Yellowstone, if it does ooze, it's going to blow.
So let's talk about supervolcanoes for a minute. I mean, the predictions or the projections are scary. I mean, the supervolcano, it's enormous.
It's happened several times in the past. I mean, the entire western United States is covered in meters of ash from the last time it went off. So if it does go off, it's going to make a god-awful mess of the wheat belt. That's no question of that.
Wasn't there a supervolcano that went off about half a billion years ago or so in Canada and buried this place?
Oh, there are lots of them.
Up by Montreal?
Yeah, yep.
Yep. You might be onto something.
That's
there.
That's Mount Moran.
Let's go to Beth in Burlington. Hi, Beth.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yeah, you're on.
Oh, good. Okay. I have a couple questions, and they're about energy and very very domestic. One of them is about gas and the difference between heating a cup of water, say for tea, in a microwave versus heating it on my gas stove, and which one would be more energy efficient? Because I wonder about this all the time. Like, mm-hmm. should I do it in the microwave, or should I, you know, heat it up in a cup of water in a teapot? And that's one of them. And the other one is one about gas, which I was going to. I asked the gas company here, and nobody knew the answer, and they kind of thought I was nuts. And I was going to buy a new gas stove, and I wondered if I bought one with a pilot light, how much energy per year would just that little pilot light have, and would it be more energy efficient? I mean, I have to pay more for one that has a electronic, and they didn't know, they didn't have any clue as to how much gas that would use a pilot light for a year. So those are my two questions.
Okay, great.
Yes.
Team?
I feel like I'm dominating, but the energy that you get out of, is it propane or natural gas?
It's natural gas, yes.
Okay, yeah. Natural gas is the most efficient means of getting fossil fuel, if you will, and creating heat energy. So if you burn a mole, about 16 grams of natural gas, which is a really small amount, you get about 1,000 kilocalories, so 1,000 calories, dietary calories of energy out. Those are ballpark figures, but if you think about 1,000 calories of energy, I'm back to my brownie plate again, but that's a lot. So it's pretty efficient using gas. So one of the rules of thumb that we use is that if you have a pilot light, a standing pilot, like on a gas stove or even on the oven part of your gas, it's like turning on a light bulb, a regular old-fashioned incandescent light bulb, and leaving it on as far as energy consumption goes. So it's hard to talk about what the volume of gas is because you don't really get delivered volumes of gas on your bill. They actually call them therms, which is this different unit. But if you can think about how much electrical energy it takes to run one light bulb in your house and just leave it on all the time, that's about how much energy you're wasting with a pilot.
Right. Well, that's a lot, really.
Over the course of a year, it is, yeah. If you're talking about a difference of, I don't know how much, there's two considerations. One is energy conservation, and the other one is saving money. So if you're just in it to save money, it'll take a number of years with the electric start or the electronic ignition before you're saving money on what you invested in the stove. But you're worried about conservation, then it's a win-win if you use the electronic ignition.
All right. And Ed, you wanted to bring something up.
I was just going to mention, as far as the other question goes, whether it's better to heat water on a stove or with a microwave, is that the microwave is actually taking the atoms of the material and twisting them to make heat effectively. While if you're heating the stove, the problem you have is that you've got air involved in the system, and air is a really good insulator. And as a result, you've got to get by that problem before you're actually heating the water.
Yeah.
So a microwave is a much better way to heat water.
And of course, you're not just doing one cup of water usually when you're on the stove. You're doing a tea kettle. And if you put the hands on the outside of the microwave, it doesn't get hot. But if you put your hands around the stove, you see a lot of heat loss to the environment.
Right.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Let's go to Joe, also in Burlington. Joe, you're on.
I'm sorry. Is this Joe in Burlington?
I think it is. Are you Joe in Burlington?
Okay, yes, I am.
Okay.
Oh, I just wanted to double check. I was buzzed out when you were identifying the location. But anyway, my question has to do with the International Space Station. I guess this is the first time on Vox Pop they had two questions and one program on the space station.
Great.
The international community has spent billions of dollars on that project. It's been floating around there and up in low-level space. I was curious when I go online and look and try to understand what experiments are being worked on and achieved up there. It seems like many of the experiments focus on human space travel or zero gravity. I was wondering, would each of your guests please perhaps explain what they consider to be the most exciting scientific achievements or science and work that's going on today in the International Space Station, since it seems to get very little attention on the news, other than space flights?
Okay.
Well, I'm going to have to disqualify myself because...
you could talk about ants in space.
I could, but I'm not going to.
All right.
I do think long-term human habitation in space is the most important, from my perspective, the important product of the International Space Station and its mission for a couple of reasons. There's the psychological issues, but I think more importantly, it's the physiology. How do humans who have been not in microgravity, who have grown up with muscle structures that require gravity as a force constantly pulling on them, how can they adjust and how does their health adjust when they're in a microgravity environment, an almost zero gravity environment, where you don't have those stressors on your muscles? We found that, you know, volume of air intake decreases. Certainly muscle tonicity goes down within 2 days of a micro space environment. So all of that has large ramifications as to whether we can exist for long duration spaceflight or propagate a planet that has significantly lower gravity like the moon, which isn't a planet, but you get my point.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So what about these other experiments that they're supposedly working on? Does anybody know what the significance ones are and what we could look forward to? I can understand the physiology of human spaceflight, but I mean, it's not like we're going to be going to Mars at any day soon, and maybe we'll go back to the moon one of these days.
Okay.
But I was able to figure out that was the main interest in many of the experiments, but is that pretty much it?
Ed? No, there's experiments. Any experiment that's involved with what effect does gravity have on the development of anything is an important one. For example, there's been a lot of work in metallurgy where they're looking at the effect of gravity on the formation of dendrites and materials,
mm-hmm.
which has a lot to do with how you make materials and how you use them.
What
have we learned as a result of that?
Information for?
Well, we use that information, for example, to produce particular types of metals and alloys, for example. A lot of that work was actually done first at RPI right here in Albany or in Troy.
I'm going to interrupt if I may. I think there are two separate questions because if I interpret the question, the original question, it's practicality.
Yeah, there's fundamental.
We have so many things we should be attending to that are urgent.
Mm-hmm.
If I read the questioner correctly, am I close?
Well, I think I could understand the physiological impacts in human spaceflight because you look at all the experiments, or you look at the list of experiments that they have on the website, and many of them are somehow associated with NASA the Air Force or some other military establishment. That's fine. I can figure that out. But when you see, you go on YouTube or you look at a broadcast from the International Space Station, you'll see walls and walls of panels which are identified as experiments.
Okay. Well, unfortunately, Jill, we're going to have to leave it there because there are many calls behind you, but I appreciate that. And
I can just interrupt. A colleague of mine during graduate school at RPI Her research was a direct product of crystals of proteins that were grown in a microgravity experiment. They won't grow here on and here, and we can't simulate no gravity here for long periods of time. But those crystals grew, and they were able to develop new high blood pressure medications based upon the querying of how the cell did its structure. And the only way for them to figure that out was to grow them in space.
All right, let's go to, the signal traveling well today. Louise in Quebec. Louise, you're on.
Hi. Yes, I'd like to ask for information. I want to know if there's any way we can neutralize the fluoride we take, like in toothpaste and mouthwash. I heard that it was very unhealthy, and is it cumulative?
Okay.
It's not cumulative unless you're dosing yourself significantly, like drinking large quantities, like 6 liters of fluoridated water a day. And the reason why mouthwashes and toothpaste are not to be swallowed is particularly for the fluoride content. Fluoride does strengthen enamel, and it is an antibacterial to a certain extent. But it over long-term, large dose issues, it can cause liver problems and also discoloring of teeth and bone.
Right.
You want to add
but is it, can you neutralize it with something else?
Well, if you're spitting
what
it
I
out,
know.
If you're spitting it out, it's not getting in your system. It's only on the coating on your teeth.
But once it's in your system, I mean, obviously when it's in your mouth absorbs through the cells, right?
Not really, no.
No.
Okay.
Oh, it's not absorbed in the mouth.
No, it sits on the surface of the teeth, and that's how it strengthens enamel. It's not absorbed through your skin in the mouth.
Yeah, all you're doing is taking calcium phosphate and turning it into calcium fluoride.
Okay, so because there's, somebody told me there's a big, I think, in Europe, they don't put fluoride in the water, and their toothpaste, supposedly, doesn't have fluoride.
Well, that's why children's toothpaste, the stuff that has like Buzz Lightyear on it, does not have fluoride in it until they're about age 4 or 5 because they worry about children swallowing the fluoride.
Okay. Louise, thank you so much for calling. We appreciate it. And we go to Amy. Amy, where are you calling from?
Hey, I'm calling from Hobart.
You are on the air.
Thanks. Thanks for taking my call. I'm so excited to talk to you all. So my question is about handmade soap making. And saponification, because I know just a little bit about it, which is that you need some kind of fat and lye, basically.
Base, yes.
And I am wondering, when I read the ingredients on a handmade bar of soap, sometimes it'll say coconut oil or palm oil, and sometimes plus lye, and sometimes it will say sodium cocoate or sodium palmate.
Okay, panel, we only have about a little over a minute here.
Okay. The eights just mean it's the salt of the fat,
mm-hmm.
So that means it's a solid form of the fat.
So does that mean it's just the same stuff in a different part of the process?
Just with a negative charge on it, yep.
Right.
So they're synonymous, and one is listing the raw ingredients and one is listing it further along, is
yes,
that right?
Yes, that's right.
Terrific.
Wow.
Great. Well, that was easy. Thank you so much.
Great. A satisfied customer. I like that. All right. We have time for one more.
My chemistry degree is paying off today.
How about that? Yeah. You're really doing double duty today. All right, Jeff, you have about 30 seconds to ask the question. The panel has 30 to answer. Go.
Okay. No, just a comment. I'm afraid we sent that young woman with the wrong answer earlier in the show. I'm afraid the sun does rise due east, only on the equinox. And as far as when you're over the Arctic Circle, when it's got 6 months of light and 6 months of dark, I still believe the sun rises due east on the spring equinox and sets in the fall equinox.
I have scientists shaking their heads.
Thank you.
It rises in true east, but it will not be due east from her. What's east at the North Pole?
I don't mean actually on the North Pole. I just mean, you know, when you're above the Arctic Circle and the sun is out for 6 months, and then it's dark for 6 months.
Okay, I'll take it for homework.
All right. That, you know, and Ed usually takes about 7 shows for Ed to come back with his homework.
That's not true.
But
I think he's back. I think we're back in December anyway.
All right. Hey, very good. Jeff, thanks a lot. You're the last one today. We appreciate it. And thanks to everybody who called in today. Support comes from Riverbend Animal Hospital, Route 9 in Hadley, Massachusetts, providing small animal medicine and wellness care, general and referral surgery, canine rehabilitation, laser therapy, and dentistry. Riverbendanimal.com. Buttermilk Falls Inn, Milton, a 75-acre Hudson Riverfront resort with lodging, a farm-to-table restaurant and spa, now booking holiday corporate and private parties and more. Buttermilkfallsinn.com. The Preservation League of New York State, Albany, New York, protecting New York's historic buildings, districts, and landscapes since 1974. PreserveNYS.org. And Berkshire Botanical Garden, Stockbridge, Massachusetts. Annual holiday marketplace featuring a gallery of wreaths, local vendors, crafts, and more. December 7th from 10 to 5 and December 8th from 10 to 4. BerkshireBotanical.org. Thanks to you for calling in. Thanks to our scientists today. Thanks to Zach Malloy, yawning over there in the master control. Wake up, Zach. Thanks to Blaze Bryant and Patrick Garrett for answering the phones. Tom Job handled the social media. Our producer, Jessica Blaustein. Marshall, I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, Moyers and Company. And then on Monday at 2, we have a very special Medical Monday all about diabetes. Stay tuned now for a news update.